From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Tanya Mosley in Culver City, California. This is Here and Now. A fist bump, not a handshake, was how President Biden greeted Mohammed bin Salman today. He's the Saudi prince who U.S. intelligence says ordered the 2018 murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Biden is under pressure to speak up about the murder. He also needs Saudi to help bring down fuel prices.
And back home, the president has other challenges. It may be game over for big pieces of his legislative agenda, notably climate change. So it's time now for our Friday roundtable. We have Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
And Francesca Chambers is with us, White House correspondent at USA Today. Francesca, happy Friday.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
And let's talk once again about Joe Manchin. This morning, the critical centrist Democratic senator said he's a no vote on an economic bill that includes spending on climate change proposals. Manchin is, of course, from a coal state, West Virginia. Here he is this morning on West Virginia Metro News Radio.
Inflation is absolutely killing many, many people. They can't buy gasoline. They have a hard time buying groceries. Everything they buy and consume for their daily lives is a hardship to them. And can't we wait to make sure that we do nothing to add to that?
Francesca, for the president's agenda, we know the clock is ticking down to the midterms. How big a blow is this?
Well, it's not just ticking down to the midterms. It's ticking down to an August recess that comes in about 3 weeks. And Democrats have many things that they had hoped to get done during that time, things that they thought would help with voters to get them out to the polls, as you were asking about. And this was a major one. The White House now saying that they're not going to negotiate in public when asked about it today on the flight to Saudi Arabia, which has consistently been their position. But Manchin has been quite clear. If inflation is high, he wouldn't vote for this. And now this may be the final blow, considering Democrats just won't have time to consider to continue negotiating with Manchin.
Yeah. And Rick, let's just step back on this issue. Ron Wyden, the liberal Democratic senator from Oregon, said this was the last chance to prevent the most catastrophic and costly effects of climate change. I mean, could this issue fall off the table for years? I mean, scientists, of course, say we need to address this yesterday.
I think Democrats are likely to lose control of at least the House, if not the House and the Senate. And in that sense, it's not going to be a front burner issue. But that's another way of looking at this, is that, you know, Joe Manchin is being vilified right now for his role in this. And I think he deserves whatever degree of blame you assign to it based on your beliefs on this. That said, what he is saying is not something that is foreign to the ears of many American workers out there who are struggling, that would rather see an emphasis on energy production that gets at gas prices right now than climate change, and that are concerned about runaway inflation. And the idea that more spending right now is the solution is not something that's going to sell very widely. So I've been struck by, there are some progressive Democrats who this week with the inflation report are coming out and saying, this is unacceptable. We need to do something about this. They almost sounded like they were the party out of power rather than the party in power. And Joe Manchin, in one way, it feels like he is saving Democrats from themselves, particularly given the 9.1% inflation that was the cause of his fresh concerns. He has signaled his position for some time now.
Rick, really quickly, can you briefly share what is left in and out of this bill?
Well, this takes out really anything you were going to do around climate change. What's left is potentially some areas to try to bring down drug prices, potentially some areas to address tax reform. But it's very minor, very narrow compared to the hundreds of billions that was initially proposed and that still was seen as a possibility. All year, the Democrats have spent 2 years now, year and a half, trying to get Manchin and Sinema on board. Manchin saying that he won't be on board for anything increases inflation by additional spending and also the climate provisions. It's a major blow to what's left of the Biden domestic agenda.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring up another major topic for this week. Francesca, I want to ask you about abortion. In Congress, Democrats are trying to protect abortion rights 3 weeks after we know the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. But Republicans blocked a bill that would have helped persons cross state lines to get abortions. And they were slammed by Democratic Senator Patty Murray. Let's listen.
There is already legislation introduced in Missouri to ban abortion travel. Anyone telling you this is not a threat is not paying attention, or they're just trying to mislead you.
Francesca, the Senate bill does not have a chance of passing. So really, what is the point?
Well, Murray is up for re-election this year, and like other Democrats who are either seeking re-election or in the case of the president and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, they've made similar comments about Republicans. This is now something that they say is on the ballot in November. The president's message here has been that you need to vote for more Democrats in both the House and in the Senate if you share the view that there should be Roe should be codified, essentially. And that's exactly where things are now, is that in the Senate, unless there's the filibuster, the rule change that is made so that you don't have to have that 60-vote threshold, you're not going to see legislation, whether it's from Republicans or Democrats, related to the issue of abortion pass. So then that takes you into the territory of, would they get rid of that rule? And there just consistently on both sides has not been enough support to get rid of that 60-vote threshold.
Now, the politics of abortion in Washington and in the country surround this horrific case of a 10-year-old rape victim in Ohio. She had to go to Indiana to get an abortion. Many Republicans doubted this story, which was eventually corroborated. Jim Jordan, the GOP Ohio congressman, called it a lie, and then he deleted that tweet. Here he is on CNN.
Why'd you delete the tweet?
Well, because we learned that this illegal alien did this heinous crime. So we deleted it.
Did you apologize for to the girl and the family for suggesting it was a lie?
Never doubted the child.
All right, the audio is not great, but we're hearing Jim Jordan asked about the deleted tweet. He says he learned this crime was committed by what he called an illegal alien. Rick, is this going to hurt Republicans like Jim Jordan?
You just saw that the Republican talking point on this change in real time. It was remarkable to see how quickly it went from this never happened to it was done by an undocumented immigrant. Totally different argument. Both, that actually has the benefit of being true, the latter piece of it. I think abortion rights is going to be an issue that gets more Democrats excited than Republicans, given where things are standing. But it's a state-by-state issue, and it also may not be a top-of-mind issue. And for many of Jim Jordan's constituents who consider themselves so-called pro-life, they're probably glad to see him do battle like this. And I think other comments about how the 10-year-old should have been forced to carry the baby to term, that's the logical consequence of what the Supreme Court ruling is in many states. It isn't something the Republicans are particularly comfortable talking about, but it is part of the political mix. And again, it just really depends on how people prioritize this issue when you line it up against so many other things that are impacting their lives right now.
Of course, the January 6th investigation in Washington continues, so I want to ask briefly about that. On Tuesday, Liz Cheney on the House Select Committee said it is looking into possible witness tampering by former President Trump. There is at least one more hearing from this panel. At this point, Francesco, what is your sense of the framing the committee is trying to achieve, and is it succeeding?
They're trying to set up a case here for the Justice Department to be able to pick up to they're at least trying to make the case that the Justice Department should investigate and prosecute the former president of the United States. So what we expect in the final hearing is for them to really drive home that point, to present every piece of evidence that they have that they think that the Justice Department could pick up, bring up for the witnesses. And while there could be more hearings in the future, this is important to know it's the last one that we currently know of that they currently have scheduled. So it would be my expectation that if there's witnesses that they haven't named yet or any other information that they have that is to that point, then that's what we're going to see.
Francesca, do you feel that the committee has managed to reframe what happened on January 6th? Is a clear picture emerging that what we knew before these hearings is dramatically different from what we know now happened that day?
Well, what's interesting about the hearings, too, is just how many other things have been taking place in the news at the same exact time as the hearings. We're talking about abortion rights. When President Biden has been traveling, there have been, him meeting with Mohammed bin Salman today at the same exact time, right, as all of these things. So it's unclear at this point, what role this is going to play in the midterm elections at this point, especially bringing it back to where we started, which is when so many Americans are concerned about inflation, they're concerned about the economy, whether or not they're going to be going to the ballot box and voting on January 6th or voting on these kitchen table issues is just something that we're still waiting to see. But if you look at polling, the economy has been voters' number one issue.
Mm-hmm. With a little bit of time that we have, the Washington Post is reporting today that former President Trump will announce another bid for the presidency in September before the midterms. Rick, do you think he's really decided? How important is this timing? I'm thinking about what Francesca just said about the news cycle.
I think the worst thing that Republicans for their prospects in the Senate and the House could have is a Trump announcement. It has no meaning now. The election's 2.5 years away. And whether the president is doing it to try to avoid some kind of legal scrutiny is going to be a question. More importantly, though, more relevantly, it helps the Democrats frame the election. They want to make this a choice between MAGA Trumpism and the Democrats who are in power. The Republicans would love to make it a referendum on Biden. But if you have Trump already inactive and announced candidate for 2024, it forces Trump into the conversation even more than he would have done so. And whatever he decides, this is going to be looming for a long time now.
Which makes a lot of reporting for the two of you going forward. Rick Klein, ABC News political director, and Francesca Chambers is a White House correspondent for USA Today. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
In the Middle East, President Biden is now on the most closely watched stop of his trip, Saudi Arabia. He flew there nonstop from Israel. And on the tarmac, the Saudis rolled out a purple carpet. As for Biden's agenda, well, it's unclear if he will bring up the 2018 killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The U.S. intelligence community believes the Saudi crown prince approved that operation. NPR's Daniel Estrin is covering the trip, and we have him on the line. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Scott.
Okay, purple carpet? Tell us about the reception the president got in Saudi Arabia.
Well, besides the purple carpet, everyone has been wondering what the meeting between Biden and MBS would look like. Mohammed bin Salman, he is the crown prince. Of course, the U.S. implicated him in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist. And Biden fist bumped MBS. And then we saw a lot of images of MBS gesturing and ushering Biden in to a meeting with his father, King Salman. A reporter with NBC attempted to ask a question to the crown prince. He said, "Will you apologize to the family of Jamal Khashoggi?" MBS didn't answer. And according to photos of the journalists who took photos there, he appears to have smirked or smiled at that question. And then the traveling reporters were promptly escorted out of the room.
Oh, wow. What a moment. I thought at one point there was not going to be any media. So quite a moment there. As far as the agenda for this visit for the president, we know oil prices are extremely high. The Saudis may be able to pump more for the world. What's at the top of the president's agenda?
You know, there's a lot on this agenda. I mean, he's meeting a summit of basically all the heavyweight Arab leaders in the region. He wants them to come together and to serve as a counterweight against Iran and China and Russia. He also wants to see the truce in Yemen continue, that war in Yemen involving Saudi Arabia against Iranian-backed proxies. The war has been going on for years. Now there's a truce. But as you mentioned, Biden has... there's been a lot of criticism about this visit to Saudi Arabia, and Biden in the past called the kingdom a pariah because of the war in Yemen and because of human rights abuses. And Biden has said he will promote human rights on this trip. We will have to see whether he will publicly speak about Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist who was killed.
Yeah, and we should note the U.S. in the past has supported the Saudis in this Yemen proxy war. In this trip, the president also went to East Jerusalem and then the Israeli-occupied West Bank to meet the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas. What happened there?
Well, you know, Biden is trying to renew ties with the Palestinians. There were very rocky years under Trump when Trump sided with Israel and took punitive measures against the Palestinians. And so Biden tried to reassure Palestinians, but Palestinians have a lot of demands from the U.S. that Biden has not been able to deliver on. He hasn't been able to reverse a lot of Trump's policies, like closing diplomatic representative offices for Palestinians in Jerusalem and in Washington. Palestinians also want Biden to hold Israel to account for the recent killing of a Palestinian-American journalist.
Yes. That's NPR's Daniel Estrin following the president's trip in the Mideast. Daniel, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Topps grocery store in Buffalo, New York reopens today. It was the site where a gunman killed 10 people 2 months ago in an act of racism. The gunman now faces 27 counts, including federal hate crime charges. Before this mass shooting, Tops was a gathering place in this predominantly black neighborhood. The area is essentially a food desert with very few stores to choose from. And community members are now asking for substantial changes beyond the reopening of a place that is still the source of so much pain and trauma. Joining us now is Jillian Hainsworth, Buffalo's first poet laureate. She has written a poem about the resilience of the community, which now stands as a memorial that greets patrons as they enter the Tops store. Jillian, welcome to Here and Now.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Tops, as I mentioned, is more than just a supermarket. It's a gathering place. You know it well as someone who grew up in East Buffalo. And we've been talking so much about the store's closure essentially turning East Buffalo into a food desert. How have you and other residents been managing during this time?
Yeah, so we have really relied on each other. A lot of our local organizations have really stepped up and taken on the responsibility of making sure that the people can eat. There's also been a shuttle bus that will take people from the community into different communities to go to grocery stores. But it is important to point out that this is one grocery store in one black community in an entire city. 85% of the black population in Buffalo live on the east side of Buffalo. So most black people in Buffalo are navigating food deserts. And these food deserts existed before May 14th, and then some of them still exist now, even with Tops being reopened.
Yes, the disparities in East Buffalo have been well documented. We were just reading research from Professor Henry Louis Taylor at the University of Buffalo, who studied the disparities in the city and found that black people in East Buffalo specifically have fallen significantly behind white residents in just about every socioeconomic category. What do you want political leaders, like perhaps the city's mayor, to focus their attention on now?
We really need people on the east side, black and brown people, to be able to own something, you know? In order for the east side to feel like our community, in order for Buffalo to feel like our home, we need some ownership. So we really need to focus on that. That will lead to being able to open up more stores, more grocery stores, co-ops, things like that.
You were at a ceremony yesterday at Tops Grocery Store. The owner, John Persons, has said that the store is now emptied out and it now has a different feel and look. That won't solve all of those systemic issues that you're talking about, but his aspiration is to make Tops for the moment as this only place that people can go to shop. A place that residents of East Buffalo will feel good about. You were there yesterday. How did it feel?
So first off, it was beautiful inside Tops. If you look at the outside of Tops, there are all of these symbols. And people are probably like, what does this mean? And they are like African symbols for like saying goodbye and transitioning. And it's just very appropriate for our community and the way we acknowledge and celebrate our culture and our history. But it also felt heavy. Mm. It felt heavy because it's like, it's nice in here and everything's new and everything is shiny, but we know what happened and we know what it took for it to look this way.
You wrote a poem about this massacre, about this moment in East Buffalo's history. It's now a memorial in the form of a plaque that now resides inside of Tops store. It greets folks as they enter. Can you read it for us?
Yes, absolutely. Let the hopeful healing waters flow. Ushering in a rebirth of our sense of self, let the flowing waters remind us of time, current yet fleeting like life itself. Large yet within reach, just as the ancestors. Let the hopeful healing waters flow, cleansing all pain and fear, all hurt and regret, Let the water heal our people, reminding us that even our small marks on this huge world are necessary. Let the hopeful, healing waters flow. Let the water tell stories of those that came before us, those who fought and believed for us, those with the strength and power of a high tide, those with the meekness of a still pond. Let the beauty of the unknown offer comfort and hope, for within water, there will always be life. Mm.
Jillian, what do you want residents to take away when they walk in the store and they read your poem?
I want them to feel a sense of healing. I wrote this poem at Broderick Park. And for people who may not know the significance of Broderick Park, it's at the foot of Ferry in Buffalo. And it was the last stop before Black people would jump into the river to try to swim over to Canada. So when I was writing this, I was kind of thinking about all of that and thinking about how much life is actually in water and how water has been such a significant symbol of transition for Black and brown people. So I want people to feel healing. I want people to feel like it's okay to say goodbye. It's okay to allow this transition to happen. So I just want people to be able to look at it and kind of breathe a little bit. I feel like as a community, we need time to just breathe, you know?
Jillian Hainsworth is Buffalo's first poet laureate and a social justice activist working for the organization Open Buffalo, talking with us about the reopening of Tops Friendly Market in East Buffalo. Jillian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The cleanup continues in southwestern Virginia after a severe storm and flooding swept away homes and blocked roads. Buchanan County in Appalachia was the hardest hit. It's near the border with West Virginia and Kentucky. And thankfully, officials say everyone is now accounted for. But a state of emergency in Virginia is still in effect. We have Ashley Lester from Buchanan County on the line. She's a deli manager at Sunny's Quick Stop, a convenience store in Raven, Virginia. Hi, Ashley.
Hi.
I understand you were driving into work Wednesday after the storm, and then you had to stop. What'd you see?
I live in Kentucky, and I was coming through and got to Buchanan County at Van Sant, and there was water in the road so deep you couldn't drive through it. Mm. And there was two ladies stranded in their vehicle, and I watched the rescue squad people take boats out there and save them.
Oh, tell me what it looked like.
Oh, it was so sad. The water was so deep, it was up to their, over their hood to their windshield, might as well say.
And so how did they get them out?
They took boats over there, rescued them and got them out and floated them over to the other side.
Yeah, wow. And eventually, you finally got to work, and I understand your convenience store stayed open, even though a lot of others lost power.
Yes, we was the only one around here that day that was open. And it was so sad seeing the people coming in here and listening to everything that they lost. It is just so sad.
What did they tell you?
We had one customer come in here, and he told us that him and his wife was asleep, and he heard something loud hit his house. It woke him up, and he said a few minutes later, water come gushing through.
Oh.
And he said that it was just so deep in his house, before he knew it, that he had to bust the ceiling out, and he grabbed a hold of his wife. He saved her. He busted the ceiling out so him and her could stick their head up in the ceiling and stay above water.
And
he said that the insulation and stuff was going in their throats and stuff. And he said that he looked at his wife and said, I wish there was a way the Lord could give us something to drink. And he said about that time his lunchbox that she'd fixed the night before came floating through their kitchen, and he grabbed it.
Wow. And you're hearing a lot of these stories? Even today?
Yes.
And tell us quickly about Buchanan County. I mean, we see from photos this part of Virginia is beautiful and mountainous, but it's also very remote, on average very poor, hard to reach people sometimes, yeah?
Yes, it is. It's It's nice around here. It's mountains everywhere. We've got a beautiful place here. Sunnies, we try to treat everybody like they're at home when they come in here. We're going to donate to them. The customer that come in here talking about him and his wife, we're going to get them clothes and stuff. You know, we're going to try to help as much as we can. Oh,
good for you. But it's going to take a lot of work, I gather, to
just put everything
back together, yeah?
My fiance's mom and them, they live over at Loggy Bottom. And luckily, their house and stuff was up a holler on a hill, so it didn't get any damage or nothing, but they are stuck. They still haven't got no power, but they can't get out. My fiance's having to go all the way around a completely different route just to get to work.
Ashley Lester is deli manager at Sunny's Quick Stop in Raven, Virginia. She's been talking to us about the flooding there, the damage there, and the long road back in Buchanan County. Ashley, thanks for the time, and we send our best to you and your team.
Thank you.
More people die by suicide in this country than in car accidents. People are hurting, and the need for mental health services is at an all-time high. Well, beginning this Saturday, people in crisis will have a new national free 3-digit hotline to call, 988. One of the goals is to make access to emergency mental health care as simple as dialing 911 for other emergencies. The federal government provided the initial funding for the new crisis line, and each state must approve ongoing funding through a tax of a few cents on phone bills, the same way 911 is funded. But so far, most states have fallen short of doing that. Dr. Christine Yu Moutier is following all of this, and she's the chief medical officer for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And Christine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Tanya.
Yes, well, first, can you share with us what this new system is meant to do? What should people call 988 for?
Sure. So 988 is for anyone who finds themselves in a state of mental health or suicidal crisis. We want to keep the net very wide open in terms of the type of human challenges we're all facing these days. So that could be for mental health, substance use, or suicidal crisis-related reasons.
You know, we've been reading about suicide rates climbing significantly, the numbers of young adults who are dealing with mental health issues. The opioid crisis has impacted families and communities. And of course, we know this ongoing pandemic has had a profound effect on all of us. Can we take a step back for a moment and you just lay out for us, how bad is it?
We are definitely in a state of what I would call a public health crisis related to the mental health and suicide risk within our nation. You know, there's a group that we're particularly worried about, which are youth and young adults in our nation, as well as specifically LGBTQ youth and people of color. Health disparities and issues of discrimination and economic, you know, strain, things like that, are certainly disproportionately affecting those individuals. And for young people in particular, if you think about the way that their lives have been affected during the pandemic, right during a period of development when they're establishing their own individuality and identity separate from their families, when they're supposed to be connecting with peers, and when a lot of that has been kind of disrupted by the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, suicide prevention hotlines have been around for quite some time. And so we do have numbers and statistics and understanding of how much those lines help folks when they're in the midst of a mental health crisis. But how much of a difference can this 3-digit national line make in this effort?
Yeah, this is a really important topic. What we've seen around the globe is that several countries were able to reduce their national suicide rates. You know, suicide is a complex health outcome and behavior, and therefore it's not going to be a one-size-fit or just a one-prong solution, but always multifaceted. But in every instance of those countries that saw reductions in their suicide-related mortality, they all had very robust crisis response systems in place. Mm-hmm. And so for the United States right now, taking this next step to have a 3-digit number, 988, so that it's easy to remember. But also, that's not the only piece of it. The other really important part of it is that Congress has appropriated more funds and support to this resource than ever in our national history. So it is a true opportunity to make mental health a priority, and also at the state and local level to build the true mental health resources that are necessary so that people can access care.
Well, let's talk a little bit about resources and funding. You say that this is a start. And really what I'm hearing when you say that is that now from this number comes the building of the infrastructure to meet the needs of the mental health crisis. Can you say more about that?
Yes. Right now, if you find yourself in a crisis, you might be sent to an emergency department, or you might be sent home with not a lot of in between, you know, and then try to find an outpatient mental health provider, you know, if you're sent home or if you're sent to the ER. What we have the opportunity to do now with 988 is for states to pass the legislation to be able to collect telecommunications fees to build a sustainable, multi-layered mental health response system that will include mobile crisis response, respite centers, trained peer specialists, more intensive outpatient treatment services, rather than the way it is in most communities right now, which is a very poorly resourced and hard to access mental health care.
Are there states that are leading the way in this effort?
Yes. However, only 4 states so far have actually passed the legislation that I'm referring to that has included the telecommunications fees that will actually fund these new mental health resources. So this is a time to raise our voice if we care about mental health, to ask our state legislators to pass the 988 legislation that includes the fees from telecoms in order to fund mental health services.
One thing that I'm curious about is how this 988 system will help the 911 system. One thing that some people may be surprised to learn is that 911 hasn't been around forever. It's just a little over 50 years old. And a big piece of this includes the effort to take mental health emergencies out of the realm of police response. We've seen a high number of police shootings that involve mental health issues. How will this system help?
Yeah, it is very likely that we will become smarter in a way about having mental health crises met with a mental health trained response rather than a law enforcement response. There are some significant differences between 911 and 988. If you think about it, 911 is a dispatch center that you reach that is able to, you know, send out the appropriate emergency response team. Whereas with 988, in over 98% of cases of people who call, chat, or text with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, now 988, the phone call, the interaction itself is the therapeutic experience. In the vast majority of cases, there is no need to send out, you know, a next step beyond that. The vast majority of people who were in a suicidal crisis or who were experiencing intense depression or anxiety, agitation, those experiences diminished and they received help just through the interaction with the 988 trained counselor.
What's happening culturally, you think, that maybe we're having a deeper understanding of the importance of mental health and resources are being put in that direction?
I'm so glad you asked about that. I feel that our culture is changing, that it's a period of transition, because in the past, we didn't have a scientific basis to understand mental health and human behavior from the standpoint of the brain, the environment, early adverse events in a person's history, genetics, that all of those things matter and make up this complex outcome that is our mental health as human beings. But mental health can change. And some of us also live with mental health conditions, just like some of us have physical health conditions. In a way, stigma has gone down because everyone is facing challenges during this period of time. And normalizing that kind of distress, as strange as that sounds, is actually a very healthy thing to realize it is human to struggle and we all have mental health to take care of.
Christine, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about this new system.
Absolutely. It's an exciting time for our country. And the biggest message to send people is that if you're experiencing concerns with your own mental health or with a loved one, certainly know that you are not alone and help is available and 988 is available to you.
Dr. Christine Yu Moutier is the chief medical officer for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And again, starting tomorrow on Saturday, you can dial 988 for the new mental health crisis line. The old hotline will also continue to work. That number is 1-800-273-TALK. Meanwhile, we need your help in telling another story. Prices for just about everything, as you know, are through the roof thanks to inflation, and many of us are making big changes to our budgets and lifestyles. If you're traveling less to save on gas, moving to find cheaper rent, or changing the way you shop for food, we want to know. Tell us how inflation is affecting your life. You can send a voice memo to letters@hereandnow.org. That's letters@hereandnow.org, or fill out a form on our website at hereandnow.org. We look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, we have our TV watching assignments because the Emmys are coming in 2 months. And as an ambassador for, shall we say, the less TV literate, I understand there's a lot worth watching this year. So says our in-house screener, NPR TV critic, Eric Deggans. Eric, hi.
Hey, I like that title, in-house screener.
Yeah, print a new business card.
I watch the TV shows so you don't have to.
Although you're telling us we have to. We should be watching because there's a lot of good stuff this year. Let's start with the perennial favorite, Succession, on HBO. It's a comedy show which raked in a whopping 25 nominations. So I watched a little bit of it. It's a show about who's going to take over daddy's company. And it certainly seems a venue for some glorious backstabbing. What is it about this season that merits all these accolades, all these nominations?
Well, you know, what's interesting about Succession, in addition to the fact that it's very well acted and it's very well scripted, it rides this very fine line between being dramatic in moments, but being this very dry comedy.
Yeah.
It's also very much a family drama that, you know, everybody struggles with, you know, problematic family members and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, Succession is one of the best shows on television. If you haven't watched it yet, the Emmys are providing a really strong argument for why you should watch it. I mean, my money's on Better Call Saul. I think that show's actually even better made than Succession.
Huh.
But I understand why people like Succession, because it's so of the moment and it's so deft and it has so many great performances in it.
Mm.
One of the things I'll give Emmy credit for is that, you know, almost all the shows that have been nominated in the major categories, comedy and drama, are all worthy of nomination.
Mm.
There are a lot worse lists you could spend time on.
No bad choices, it seems. Yeah. Okay, another Academy favorite is Severance on Apple TV+. It starts with a woman in office dress, locked in a conference room, taking a strange survey. Let's listen.
Now, to start, who are you?
That's the first question.
First name will do.
I don't...
It's okay. If you can't answer the question, feel free to say unknown.
What is this?
Okay, unknown.
Unknown, Eric. Weird way to start a show. Where does it go from here?
So Severance is this odd idea. It's about a world where a corporation has come up with a surgical procedure that can sever your memories at work from your memories at home. So when you're at work, all you know is that environment.
Huh.
And when you pass this threshold, you go down this special elevator and you go out to your car. By the time you reach the parking lot, you don't have any memory of what happened inside the building. And so, you know, you could see sort of security-minded, you know, corporations wanting to do this. But what also ends up happening is that these people become two people. Because, you know, there's somebody who's had all the experiences inside the building, and then there's somebody who's having all the experiences outside the building, and neither one of them is very much aware of the other. And has all sorts of implications about corporatism and work-life balance and all that sort of stuff. But it's just filled with great performances. And it's the kind of TV show that even 5 or 6 years ago, the Emmy Awards would have had a hard time recognizing, because it's new, it's quirky, And it's on Apple TV Plus, which is a smaller platform.
Yeah.
And I do think it's great that the Emmy Academy realized that these shows are worthy of inclusion alongside shows like Ozark and Better Call Saul that have been nominated for multiple times over multiple years.
Speaking of the TV Academy, Eric, there were not as many nominations for actors of color this year, just 25 compared to 41 last year. Why?
Well, and this is my own tally, you know, looking at all the nominees and, you know, what the Emmy Academy did in its acting categories was sort of look at the shows that were nominated as Best Drama and Comedy and nominate much of the cast from some of those shows. Mm. They're not considering that there may have been great performances in shows where the whole show isn't necessarily considered competitive with the best shows in that genre. Now, one bright spot in this, or there have been several bright spots, you know, Squid Game made history as the first non-English language show to get nominated as Best Drama.
Yep.
And a lot of its actors also got nominated, which is wonderful to see. And in fact, you know, helped Asian performers do better this year than they had last year. And Abbott Elementary, you know, the hit comedy on ABC, that got nominated. And, you know, the star and creator, Quentin Brunson, got nominated. And two of her colleagues also got nominated. And they were all, you know, those are all performers of color. But one thing that really worries me is that I think this dip in diversity in acting nominees, part of it is the way Emmy votes. But part of it was also that there were just less shows featuring prominent characters of color that could even have been considered. And so that's something we have to keep an eye on, because Hollywood has a way of getting complacent. And Squid Game and Abbott Elementary is not going to be enough. We have to do better.
Mm.
So that's something I hope the industry learns from these Emmy nominations.
All right. Well, that's a good place to end it, on the quaint anachronism of a network series that we should be watching.
Exactly.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Yeah, we got to run so we can start watching. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Tanya Mosley in Culver City, California. This is Here and Now.